met de Edison, sir. Thank you, sir. New York, get your paper.
Hitler has not yet been withstood by a great nation with a willpower the equal of his own. Many of these countries have been poisoned by intrigue before they were struck down by violence. They have been rotted from within before they were smitten from without. How else can you explain what has happened to France, to the French army, to the French people, to the leaders of the French people? It is no war of chieftains or of princes, of dynasties or national ambitions. It is a war of peoples and of courses. There are vast numbers, not only in this island, but in every land, who will render faithful service in this war, but whose names will never be known, whose deeds will never be recorded. This is a war of the unknown warriors. But let all strive without failing, in faith or in duty, and the dark curse of Hitler will be lifted from our age.
Well, it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to the online BCFM Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Couldn't do the show without you, Martin, really, because you add that little, take that step back and take a much bigger perspective. And that's what we are suffering from so much with the mainstream media. The mass media nowadays is they'll show you a tiny little snapshot of something that's going on with no perspective and no proper analysis. Anyway, in the second hour this week, after Putin's big World War II speech last week, this week he successfully changes the Russian constitution in a referendum to allow himself to stay in power for another decade. Why do those stupid Russian people keep voting for him? Have they been brainwashed? Or have we? And China brings its new national security law into Hong Kong, effectively ending the one country, two systems, which was supposed to last until 2047. Well, we're not even halfway there, and free expression as well as the right to peaceful protest has gone overnight. Not much left now. It's only that Chinese troops, many of whom see Hong Kongers as agents of the West, aren't yet on the streets. We speak to two local people, one student and one 30-year-old Hong Kong person who's living and working here in Bristol. And the Bank of England won't hand over 1 billion in gold, pounds that is, that Venezuela has sitting in their vaults. They think Guaido should be president, not Maduro, even though Guaido lost. Can anyone trust the old lady of Thread and Needle Street again with their loot? And as construction of the Nord Stream 2 passes Denmark and approaches North Germany, ready to supply Europe with cheap Russian gas, America slaps new sanctions on and Germany is not impressed. But will they actually do anything? Also, the pharmaceutical industry suffered a blow not being able to smuggle their mandatory vaccine schemes past under cover of the pandemic, giving us more time to find out if the information isn't smothered by propaganda or censored off the air, to find out what they're up to and how they care more about their profits than our health. Finally, the NuGenics. Yes, that's right, NuGenics and the Algorithm Ghetto, author of IBM and the Holocaust, Edwin Black, reflects on what he sees as the Nazi-style agenda behind the coronavirus hysteria. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. So, joining me to review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Martin, hi, welcome to the show.
Hello there.
Hello, Martin. So, what's been in your mind? Anything big in the national news or local news this week?
Well, I did an interview for Russia Today yesterday about the referendum.
Well, yeah, we'll be talking about that in the second hour. Anything in the local or national news?
Well, obviously, like everybody, we've got the end of the lockdown supposedly released tomorrow, pubs opening, etc.
I mean, it's going to be an avalanche, isn't it?
Well, I don't really have much confidence in the government's managing of the whole crisis. And I think that it's likely that mistakes are being made even as we speak. But there's plenty of discussion about that going on in the mainstream.
Will you be down the pub?
I don't really fancy it, to be honest. It's not going to be the same. You're not going to be able to interact with people properly. I mean, the whole joy of going to pubs is to be able to chat with people and make new friends and so on. It's just not going to be possible. And basically, potentially dangerous as well. I'm likely not to, actually.
Do you think people will be talking about the lockdown at pubs? That's what people used to do.
Well, presumably, yes. I think what they're likely going to be, they're going to be full quite easily, quickly, because they've got to keep people socially distanced. And they'll fill up, and then if you go to the shop, you can be pretty certain that the people in the shop will come out quite quickly once they've done their shopping. But if you're queuing up outside a pub, the people inside might decide that they're just going to sit there all night, and you're never going to
go to the pub, Martin. You might only get half an hour in there, then you've got to go.
Well, indeed. All in all, I'm not really that keen to go.
I'm surprised, because I would have thought that's the sort of place that you can actually pick up sort of street level gossip that you will never get.
Normally pubs would be my second home, but I just don't feel particularly at the moment that it's going to be the same sort of experience, or that you're going to be able to interact with people in the way that you normally could.
Obviously, the virus is the main topic, going to be the main talking point, as people are chit-chatting, making new friends, even if it is over a 2 metre distance. I suppose they might have to have a can with a string in between to be heard if there's a bit of a racket, because you're 2 metres away.
Well, you're not allowed to sing either, of course. No singing.
No singing?
No music, because that spreads virus.
It's a bit, isn't it? All a bit puritanical, a bit like Cromwell.
Well, it's... What it is shambolic. We don't really... I mean, in New Zealand, of course, people can go to the pub like they used to do, because they crush the virus in short order, like the All Blacks rugby team. We, on the other hand, have completely messed up at every stage.
Martin, I know you keep saying this, but we were far much further down the line. We had, you know, possibly even hundreds of thousands, some say millions of cases of the COVID-19 in Britain before anyone really realised what was going on. And, you know, New Zealand and Britain actually locked down at the same time. It's just that they didn't have the cases we did.
No, and obviously they got more warning than we did. But nevertheless, I think there's probably going to be an inquiry about this, although the government are trying to wriggle out of it. Starmer was interviewed on LBC, I think, and he was saying, well, there'll have to be one at some point. And, of course, what will come out there is that Dominic Cummings decided to go for herd immunity, and they stopped testing and didn't lock down. That probably cost tens of thousands of lives compared to other comparable countries.
Okay, so Serco and Deloitte are two major companies, private public companies, if you want to call them that. They have lots and lots of work in the public sector, but they're actually run privately. Both of them have major roles in the pandemic to do with testing and rolling out the testing program. And yet, for example, Deloitte, Martin, just literally last year were fined £6.5 million over misconduct of the audit of Serco, and then the Serco tagging scandal. They were fined another £4.2 million. That's over £10 million altogether, because they're just fraudulent. What they're doing is they were saying that people still had tags, and they were charging the Department for Justice for them when those people had actually been released and the tags have been taken off. So these are obviously an untrustworthy company. How come they've been put in the driving seat when it comes to testing?
Well, I mean, there's not even been a competitive tender for this. Well, it's because of the government's religious belief in the purity of the private sector. You know, they haven't actually got any background in test and trace. In places like Germany, it's basically the healthcare system has been geared up to do test and trace. So it has been run from the GP surgeries and so on. But to bring in, you know, you're completely, you know, they're basically bog standard companies that do anything. And they said they can do this. But of course, they're not really, you know, they're having to basically recruit new staff from scratch.
Let me put it to you that one of the reasons that they've been being fined over the last, well, I mean, it's probably 10 years, Deloitte and Serco, over the last 10 years, regular fines, is because they are just breaking the law willy-nilly, knowing that the fine will nowhere near cover the what it would have cost them if they'd have obeyed the law. So they're actually awash with cash. And the central government is saying, well, who can afford to sort this out? And Deloitte steps up to the plate, Serco steps up to the plate and says, oh, well, we've got, you know, billions of pounds just slopping around here. We can do whatever you want.
Well, that's right. And as I say, there's been no competitive tendering on it. It's basically crony capitalism. I understand one of the heads of one of those companies was a Bullingdon Club member, etc. You can see how the country's being run. It's an old boys' network.
Also, bringing things down to a bit more of a local level now, what about the council's catastrophic £82 million black hole due to the virus? This is Bristol City Council, apparently. I don't know if any of the reserves might cover this, but apparently it's urgent for the government to engage in conversations with local authorities, says Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees. He's saying, you know, he's flagging up here that the city may go bankrupt because of the virus and the government not supplying the city with the money to deal with it.
Well, that's a general problem across the country. The finances of local government have been completely destabilised. Now, you'd have thought that in that circumstance, the government would step in and say, don't worry, we'll back you up. They've done that with the private sector, of course. Lots of private companies have received lots of taxpayer money in order to keep them in business. But because of their war on local government, especially in big cities run by their political opponents, the Labour Party, the chances are that we're going to have an ongoing crisis in local authority funding. It's going to lead to situations where certain things are just not going to be paid for. They're just going to close, like toilets.
And one of the things that, of course, local authorities can do, one of the biggest resources they've got is land. Sell that land off as much as they can in order to fill that funding gap rather than go bankrupt.
Well, that's right. And of course, what then happens is it becomes a fire sale by local authorities to try and scramble for solvency. And of course, councillors are individually liable if they don't balance the books. And, the vulture capitalists are waiting to snap up all of this development land.
Interesting, isn't it, that the councillors get no say, really, in what happens. These are decisions made by the mayor, and yet they're the ones that are liable. Anyway, I thought we'd have a chat to the former mayor of Bristol, George Ferguson, about some of the things that have been going on in the city, and particularly the secrecy involved. This is something that's been a running sore, really, through the time of Marvin Rees, the Labour mayor's, presidency, his mayoralship. Is everything's been getting more and more secret. The councillors themselves can't find out what's going on. And the latest we hear, an exclusive on this show from George Ferguson, is a large piece of land at Cannon's Wharf, I think it's called, or Cannon's Marsh, which is just next to the watershed opposite the Arnold Feeney. Big open space there is being sold off by the council secretly. So let's have a listen now to that interview with George Ferguson I did a couple of days ago.
I'm George Ferguson, probably better known in Bristol as the old mayor, but my lifetime has been about architecture and urban design. I've been president of the Royal Institute of British Architects. We formed the Academy of Urbanism, which brings together professionals involved in good placemaking. So, my life has been about making good places, really, and studying cities across the world.
So you had an opportunity to do that as mayor of Bristol. Did you manage to get certain parts of the city set aside for cultural use, for public use? Because, as we know, and I'm sure you know, these developers and speculators are constantly looking for bits of land in cities that they can build, basic stuff like hotels that make lots of money, luxury housing that make lots of money. And that's surely something that you've got to be pushing against. You've got to try and make really the public, you've got to look after the public interest. Otherwise, the entire city will be turned over to housing and money making exercises.
I think it's, what's really important, it's not necessarily a negative thing. What's really important is about getting a good balance. Good places are made out of a mix of uses. And when you get commercial development, whether it's commercial residential development or commercial office or retail development, is often a monoculture. I mean, it's, for instance, the huge company that's just gone bust that owns all those shopping centres. All they did was shopping centres. And, there's virtually zilch cultural content in what they did. And the big national house builders, all they do is house building. they talk about units. They don't talk about homes. They don't bring life to the place, and they don't contribute enough to the cultural and educational provision that should be part of these places.
Okay, so were you able to, sort of take the map of Bristol and, draw squares on it and say, well, actually, this part of the city I want to be preserved for some sort of public use or cultural use, or are you able to do that as a mayor?
To a certain extent, but, it's a process that's been happening over years in this city. And, ever since I came to the city in 65, so I'm still a newcomer in some people's minds. Ever since I came to the city as a student in 65, there have been plans, local plans, that have been looking at just this sort of thing. And I think those plans have moved to a large extent from being you'll put housing here and you'll put offices here to having a much more nuanced approach by planners to the way one develops things. And I got involved in the big row over the development of Harbourside, and because I felt that was, they were taking in the 80s, 90s, a very old-fashioned planning approach. When I say old-fashioned, I mean in a bad way. And it was just going to be a big office scheme and a big residential scheme, and a few of the, any retail in there would have just been standard national stuff, like one sees in shopping centres. And very little of that, incidentally, anyway. So there, I think what I was keen on doing was taking advantage, for instance, around the Temple Meads area. As a city, your planning powers are relatively weak. Your ownership powers are very strong. So a city can use the land it owns in a very creative way. And it is a terrible waste if you use the land you own just to feed the developers. And so I actually acquired land around Temple Meads because I saw Temple Meads as moving the center of gravity of the city to a large extent. And famously, I was proposing the arena there, more than proposing it. We had builders ready to build it. And because I didn't want it just to become a commercial area. And we acquired the old sorting office, which is now to become part of the University of Bristol. And, I think bringing in education and culture to help the mix in development is a really, really important thing to do. Otherwise, we get unreal, rather artificial places.
Now, you do go back a few years, and I know once Bristol, because the thing is, the character of the city has changed, George, hasn't it? It used to be a very important port. The floating harbour used to be where all the ships came in down the Avon Gorge. Then that all moved out to Portbury, Avonmouth, and suddenly you're left with almost a purposeless dock. What do you do with it? As I understand it, there was even talk about filling it in and building office blocks on it.
Well, yeah, there was real talk about, it was mainly about car parking. Why do we have all this dirty water? Why don't we park cars there? And the whole of Cannon's Marsh was virtually a car park in those days. Car parking seemed to be the principal driver, and I remember there was one of the multi-storey car parks in the city centre that's just off Queen Charlotte Street and near Bristol Bridge. And the then city planning officer gave a planning permission to a developer who wanted to build a 10-storey office block and said, well, you can have your planning permission for a 10-storey office block if you put 6 stories of car parking below it. What he meant is if you raise it by 6 stories and we build a multi-storey car park underneath it. And that was the attitude to planning. It was nothing to do with how you make a decent place. It was all to do with numbers, which I'm afraid we're going back to. And I do criticise the current mayor about that. He's driven too much by numbers. And if you're just driven by numbers, you lose the quality of place. And that is really important in terms of sustainability, in terms of people enjoying the place that's created. Because if they don't enjoy it, if you build the sort of housing, the sort of places people don't want to live and work in 30, 40 years' time, they will be demolished again. And that's a terrible waste. And we've seen that happening from some of the stuff that went up in the 60s and 70s when I first arrived in Bristol. And I'm afraid we are going back to some of the development that is likely to have a relatively short life or be very tacky in quite a short time.
Now, and what about this site near the Arnolfini? Because I understand that that was originally earmarked as some sort of cultural site where we weren't quite sure what was going to happen with it. But now it looks as if it may not, it may be basically put into private ownership of some sort where there won't be any kind of public offering at all.
Well, it's a brilliantly valuable site that belongs totally to the city.
So where are we talking about, first of all?
It's directly opposite Arnolfini on the Lloyds Bank side, on the Bordeaux Quay side. It is quite a big open space that is adjacent to the big Lloyds Bank Crescent. A lot of people know it as a place where we have festivals and foodie events and things like that. There was a plan that I was quite involved in to build a centre for the performing arts there. It was when the big lottery money was coming out for the millennium. And it was at the time we did build Explore, which is now called We the Curious, and Wild Screen, which is now the Aquarius. And it was going to be one of the most fantastic music buildings in the country, and unfortunately it was approved, and then Newcastle came up with a scheme that went and stole the money effectively. So we were left with that site. Now that site's been there now for 25 years with an expectation of it becoming a cultural place, being a place for the people, being some sort of people's palace. Now, I can always see that you might put some other form of development on the upper stories, but to me, that site is one that belongs absolutely to the people of Bristol. And yet, secretly, the council have gone out to a competitive bid from developers, invited developers, competitive bid includes design. And it only emerged very recently that one of those developers has been granted a development license by the council, or certainly it has been drawn up. Whether that has been granted, I doubt, because it hasn't been to cabinet. But this has all happened under the counter. And we've not seen the designs up.
Sorry, George, to interrupt you, but surely a process like that has to be, some sort of open competition. It sounds to me as if you're inferring there that it's a kind of invite only, that various people have been approached, asked to come up with something for it. I mean, it surely has to be publicly advertised, doesn't it?
Well, it should be. I'm sure they've somehow got round it, but I mean, if I'd try and do that, I would have been absolutely roasted. I was criticized for certain things, but they were all open, and they were open to scrutiny. This somehow has slipped through the net. We've never seen, I think we should have had a public display of the options available. The public should have been involved in thinking about what sort of public use there could be on the site. And it looks as if all we're going to end up with is an office block and yet another hotel.
Well, it might be that the reason that it that Marvin Rees, the Labour mayor, hasn't been criticised over it is that people didn't know about it, George.
Well, I'm sure that's true. That's happening a lot. Scrutiny, which is never fun for a mayor, although is vitally important in public life, scrutiny seems to have gone out the window. I don't understand. I suppose it's because, very differently to me, I was an independent mayor. I didn't have any councillors. He is a Labour mayor, and he's got the majority of councillors. So, in a way, they can get away with things that an independent never can, if, you know, never could if he'd wanted to, he or she had wanted to. But I'm amazed at what they are getting away with at the moment, and that these things just crop up.
I'm sure Marvin would say, if he were here with us, but he would say, wouldn't he, that the only way to get development done in this city is to just get on with it. The idea that every member of the public, that every councillor should have a veto on what you're doing, that's the problem that we've suffered from in the past, that it's just a very, very slow decision-making process and things just don't happen.
It's a matter of getting the balance right. This city suffered terribly in the days pre-consultation from, you know, some of the rubbish that went up in places like Lewin's Mead. And those were just bulldozed through, and some of the council estates and things. They were just bulldozed through. They weren't, there was no consultation at all. But I think public participation has improved planning. And yes, of course, you don't want to drag things out forever with loads of inquiries and what have you. But complaining about delay is to use it as an excuse for not having any form of public participation or consultation is not legitimate. I mean, that's there are some developers who are very good at consultation. I mean, I think that Martin Griffiths, who happens to be done the Bristol Stadium project for at Ashton Gate, Bristol City Stadium and Ashton Gate, I think he has been very keen to consult what goes on there, and I think has managed to create something that I very much helped with when I became mayor. I thought Bristol City Football Club was stuck with a terrible argument about whether they could build on Ashton Vale or not. I'd said, why don't you see whether you can be released of the obligation that you have to Sainsbury's to build a great big shed on there, because I knew Sainsbury's were losing the appetite for building new sheds. They went to see Sainsbury's. Sainsbury's were clearly relieved of the obligation, and the Bristol City Football Club got on with the development. Now, there is a cultural, a sporting use at the heart of a development that will grow into more things as well. And I think that that is a healthier way of developing a site that has a real cultural purpose than just simply trying to build a huge supermarket or an office park on it.
I mean, the mayor would argue, for example, with Western Harbour, that he wants a team that are all committed to build it, and that's what he's done. He's chosen people rather than involving councillors and a lot of public consultation to get a bunch of people who are behind the project to drive it forward.
Yes, I mean, I've seen the group of people that he's appointed. I find there are some good people there, and there is the chair of it is somebody who is, you know, virtually John Savage, who pushed the whole idea of developing at Western Harbour. And I'm not against the principle of development of Western Harbour, but this bonkers idea of building a bridge, it was absolutely appallingly handled. The idea of building a bridge to replace the Cumberland Basin Bridge halfway between it and the Clifton Suspension Bridge is still held on by the mayor as a feasible project, would he? It's absolutely crazy. And he could have saved himself and the city so much time and money.
Well, why is it crazy? George, why? Why crazy?
Well, it's you talk about culture. I mean, the idea of building a highway bridge, anyway, it doesn't work. You know, the angles don't work. But the idea of building a big highway bridge in one of the most iconic views in the country, you know, of any city view, the view, the view down the Avon, under the Clifton Suspension Bridge, which would really, really, wreck that view, is completely mad. I don't know how it came up as a serious option. And anyway, I mean, it was a terrible idea to build a portway, you know, to build a highway down one of the great natural, you know, one of the greatest natural beauty spots and places for wildlife and flora and fauna, the Avon Gorge. But then to exacerbate that by a new bridge bringing traffic across there is crazy. They didn't look at the fundamentals.
Well,
the
surely, George, sorry to interrupt you again, but surely what they're doing is they're thinking, well, we want to do a lot of building here. Let's move the bridge westward to give more space to get that building sorted out. I mean, that's surely their thinking.
Yeah. Well, that was the idea, but actually it doesn't create more than a couple of hundred extra space for more than a couple of hundred.
I suppose
extra,
the problem is
dwellings there.
They're looking at it as almost like a kind of map section from above, rather than taking into account what the actual view for most people is going to be like.
Well, look, it was a report done by engineers, Arabs, who are very good engineers, but the idea, you know, then a very false idea was given that by moving the bridge you could add thousands of new homes. Which is just simply not true. And I think most people involved, most people looking at it now, realize the bridge is a non-starter. You know, a phone call to Historic England, what used to be English Heritage, would have told you this is a non-starter. This, you know, this will simply not be given permission. There was no fundamental thinking about how do we deal with the big issues. One of the biggest issues is the potential of flooding the centre of the city. That needs to be dealt with at Avonmouth. At Avonmouth, then you could get a crossing to the river that relieves the traffic off the M5 if the M5 bridge is closed. This is driven by Highways England, but Highways England are not thinking about the flooding, they're just thinking about the roads. And we need to bring all these things together to get a solution that works for everybody. And actually, one could dramatically reduce the amount of traffic going over the Cumberland Basin, and which is exactly what we need to do. We shouldn't have traffic charging down the Avon Gorge, thundering into the centre of the city from the southwest at such a crucial point. There are other ways of dealing with it. And then that's used as an excuse for building virtually a new town called Western Harbour. But Western Harbour is, you know, is heading for disaster if it's again, driven by numbers rather than creating a good place. Great, yeah, the city, the bits of this city that we love are driven by people who wanted to create good places. The streets in this city, which I, you know, I mean, the Bedminster streets, okay, they're not great architecture, but they make lovely places. And I fear that that the numbers that are being talked about will end up with hideous high buildings. I mean, already the applications in that area are for 9-story buildings, which are completely out of scale with what's around in that in the view of the suspension which belongs to us all.
Okay, let's get back to the team that's been put together to make this happen. I mean, as you say, it's a largely a John Savage project, which I believe he published way, gosh, was it back in 2010 or something?
Yeah, I remember it well. I've got a copy. It's Bristol 2050, I think it was.
Well, that's right. Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, this is basically Business West's idea. Obviously, this is what the developers and the speculators wanted to do. But there's this team been put together, which doesn't include any councillors or really local community groups. The idea, I suppose, from Mayor Rees, Marvin Rees's point of view, is to, he wants this to happen and he doesn't want too many people to be interfering.
You could take that line. I mean, there's some very good people on there, but they're largely people who don't want to disagree with Marvin. There's talk in setting up that about people with the necessary expertise. Well, there are lots of people there without the expertise. So I don't quite get that. There are only two or three people who I'd say have the right sort of expertise for considering new development of that sort. One is David Mallow, who's an architect, who is a colleague of John Savage's and very much part of the of Business West. The other is Martin Griffiths, who developed the new Ashton Gate Stadium, and he does know about development and he does know about mixed development. Apart from that, okay, I think there is a property agent, but you know, the last person you need for developing a good place is a property agent. Apart from that, I don't see any real expertise in urbanism, in creating good urban places. I don't see anybody there who knows about the history of the place. So I don't see people who are genuine representatives of the community. And as you say, no elected members. They're all just appointees and they were thrust upon us.
What about this style of doing things? Because, I mean, certainly when you were mayor, this isn't the way you got things moving, by simply appointing a group of people you think can make things happen. And I just wonder what you make of this style. I mean, we've also seen changes to the constitution of the city to give less power to the elected representatives, the councillors. Things seem to be moving in a more autocratic direction. And I think for many people, when they first had a mayor, George, they were worried that it was going to be putting too much power in one person's hands.
Yeah, and you were one of those people who were worried about that.
Yes, nice. Well, yeah, I wasn't the only one. It was actually quite a low percentage of people that actually came out to vote to have a mayor in the first place. So I just wonder what you make of the way that it's all panning out. I mean, I think, you know, most people would say things went reasonably well when you were in charge, but it's taking a bit of a new direction with the setting up these sorts of organisations which don't have elected representatives on them.
Yeah, I was incredibly fortunate. I was the only independent elected mayor of a major city in the UK, and the only independent in a major political position in the UK, really. And the great thing about being an independent is that you've got to involve others. Therefore, I had to set up a cabinet that was cross-party, that was a rainbow cabinet. I had to involve councillors from their areas and from different parties in decision making. I had to be scrutinised by those councillors on all the decisions that I took, and sometimes was ripped apart for in the process. And so I think that was healthy. I think the problem is now that councillors, and including Labour councillors, I know that, a feeling that they are being left out. And I think that's really unhealthy. I mean, that's not good for our democratic system. And so I don't see a great advantage of having a very politicised mayor. I think I've seen some of the mayors of political parties virtually becoming independents. Ken Livingstone, did become an independent, although he was always, you know, his heart was very much in the Labour Party. But, I mean, he acted in an independent way as the mayor of London. And I think some of the metro mayors are acting as independents to a large extent, like Andy Burnham in Greater Manchester and Andy Street, Andy Burnham's Labour, Andy Street's Tory. But they put their place first. They don't put their party first. And I think at the moment we are suffering terribly in Bristol from a very politicised mayor. And we also have a metro mayor from the opposite party who is a nice man but not being very effective. And I think they are not helping each other. And I think now I've come to the conclusion that we'd be better off with a strong metro mayor that represents the city region, like the good representation that Birmingham and Manchester both have, and dispense with Bristol having an elected mayor. And I've always thought that the metro mayor was the right answer. We should be looking at city regional mayors, not competing mayors in the same region.
Now, I'm just finally getting back to this this possible development next to Arnold Feeney. I mean, this is something, surely, George, that if it goes ahead, I mean, that's that place lost, really, to the public.
Well, it is, and it is. It's an absolute peach of a site. I mean, we've kept that site, and it should be kept until something of public benefit goes on it. I'm not saying it needs to be 100% public benefit, but it should be, you know, I think that land, the space, you know, maybe underneath other uses, should be for public benefit. It has, you know, even just as an open space now, it's very much for public benefit. And I think it would be an absolute, you know, a appalling loss to the city. It is such a key position on that bend at the end of St. Augustine's Reach, going round into the main floating harbour, is absolutely key, which is why we had the plan to put the Centre for the Performing Arts there. I went to the Tate Gallery at the time I was mayor, suggesting that maybe they would like a Tate of the West there. I know there's a little Tate in St. Ives, but I just thought, yeah, and there's a Tate in Liverpool. I thought, you know, if one might put something there that worked across the water with Arnold Feeney. I also went to the Guggenheim and suggested that they might fund some Guggenheim there. Now, neither had the appetite to do it, but I think it needs that sort of thinking, not just to give it over to being just yet another commercial development. I think that would be a criminal loss.
Is there anything that we can do? Because it seems that a lot of these sorts of decisions are like this one being done in secret. Anything we can do to kind of keep on top of this? Because, I mean, if this is happening in secret, it's almost as if it's the council has become some sort of commercial operation, almost like a business.
Well, I don't understand why more fuss is not being made by councillors. Maybe they've just given up because they despair of being able to change things. I don't understand why a bigger fuss is not being made by councillors about this. There's something funny going on. Yes, I think there ought to be an absolute uproar, media and political uproar, about this whole project getting this far without us as citizens knowing about it.
Well, that's the former mayor of Bristol, George Ferguson, there. Now, I have to say, I'm always asking Marvin, texting him and emailing him, Marvin Rees, the Labour mayor, to come on the show and explain himself, particularly when it comes to these kinds of secret decisions. But this, Martin, really is an insult. The idea that a piece of land that's been being kept for cultural use in the city has been secretly to a few cherry-picked, hand-picked developers, they've been offered quietly without the public knowing to put various options on it, and a decision has been made behind closed doors. Now, this is secrecy, and this is our public space. So as a Labour mayor, you know, this is not really a Labour policy, I would have thought.
Well, I'm very interested to hear all this conversation. because a lot of this stuff is new to me. Although obviously I've heard
it isn't really, is it? We have exactly I've heard the George process. About it's not new because we had the same process up at Temple Meads with what they call Temple Island there. Again, secret process. This the contract or the land just simply awarded to somebody. In that case, I can't remember who it was, but this is the way things seem to be going now. I would suggest, we heard quite a lot about John Savage there, the former master of the Merchant Venturers, the former right-wing Labour member who he was a member of the Labour Party anyway, resigned when Jeremy Corbyn became leader. And it does seem to me as if this is Savage's project. It's Savage's book from 2010, not really Marvin Rees's idea when he was elected in 2016. It's more Savage.
Well, I think that to cut to the nub of the matter, elected mayors were a fad of the Cameron Conservative government, but the idea was that once you've elected the mayor, they then decide everything, and there's a real question about whether local councillors have any purpose at all.
Now, I don't think anyone is quibbling, and George isn't there either, about the mayor making the final decision. But the idea is that it's a bit like China, actually, and their national security law. We're told what's happened afterwards. There's no possibility for any kind of scrutiny beforehand. Now, that doesn't sound very Labour. It doesn't sound very democratic to me.
Well, I don't believe in elected mayors. When Ken Livingston, who was mentioned by George, was running the GLC in the 1980s, he wasn't an elected mayor. He was the leader of the Labour group on the council, on the GLC. And Livingston is on the record as saying, I don't believe in elected mayors. I don't believe in elected mayors. I think that George there has obviously got to, he's a bit frustrated because he used to run the city and now he doesn't. But at the same time, he pushed for the idea of elected mayors. And the problem with elected mayors is that they are designed to be autocrats. That was the whole idea. And that the idea is once you've got an elected mayor, they're going to bulldoze stuff through, get rid of all, that's what the Conservative
government. Martin, let's just get back to what I said a moment ago, because what I'm saying is that the secrecy isn't necessary unless you want
to. Secrecy isn't necessary.
Stifle debate.
Necessary, Tony, but it's there, written into the. Marvin is within his rights to do all of this. He shouldn't be.
So he's running the city.
Mayors should have those powers, but they do.
If he's going to run the city like a business, is it a farm? Are we his little farm animals?
Well, he's designed to be a CEO of Bristol Incorporated. That's what mayors are supposed to be. That was the original conception behind the Tory idea of mayors, which they'd taken from the United States of America. Now, I don't agree with mayors. I don't think there shouldn't be. What's obviously happening now, we talked earlier about the finances of the council becoming completely destabilised. And of course, there's a solution to that, which is because business rates are going to be in the hands of the council that one says they would take. I mean, that's what gave Ken Livingston such power in the early 80s. He still had control of business rates, so he could whack a business rate on the City of London, and he's got a huge slush fund to spend on whatever he wants. And of course, the Tories got rid of him, got rid of the GLC, got rid of the business rates, and put the business rates were now paid into central government, and then all money for local authorities
government. But hang on. What about this? The Western Harbour Board, one of the people sitting on it, for example, is the regional boss of Wilko Stores, the hardware chain. Yes. Now, what are they going to be supplying the spanners to build the houses? Why are they there?
Basically, what you're delineating there is a pro-business, pro-development agenda. And, of course, why a Labour mayor may be drawn in that direction is because it can plug. If you've got lots of commercial property, you can then get the business rate money from that, and you can then pursue whatever little pet projects you've got.
So I suppose the council's attitude is, look, we need loads more things we can tax, like little rabbit hutch houses.
Yeah, and then that's right. And of course, because there's no fairness in the distribution of resources at local or national level. I mean, the Tories are rewriting now the standard spending assessments to rebalance it in favour of rural areas. So the money that local authorities get is based on an index of deprivation I actually used this index of deprivation when I was doing some analysis for Bristol Debt Advice Centre a decade ago. And the point is they're now rejigging it so that rural areas, which obviously tend to be more prosperous areas, are going to get more money and inner cities are going to get less. And ultimately, you've either got to fund local authorities through local taxation, local income tax, rates, something like that, or it has to be funded by central government. Central government basically is cutting off. They've reduced the money available to local authorities enormously in the recent years. And the only solution from one point of view is just to allow, especially a city like Bristol, which is so relatively successful, is let development rip, and then you'll get some resources from taxing those developments.
Yeah, it would be lovely to ask Marvin Rees. With the devil. It would be lovely to ask Marvin Rees what he makes of that, see if he's channeling John Savage, or maybe having both of them on.
Well, I mean, don't forget, if the council's going bankrupt anyway, what options have you got? Yeah. What options are there?
There is corruption.
We've all been forced
into a whiff of corruption
by central government.
There's a whiff of corruption in much of this, particularly when business friends are given contracts or offered contracts behind closed doors. And that came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week when they were looking at local government fraud.
Welcome back. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Following the publication of MHCLG's report on the 8th of June into the risks of fraud and corruption in local government procurement, does the Prime Minister agree that procurement fraud betrays the taxpayer? It erodes public trust in our democratic systems, and we should take firm action against those that waste our public money.
Yes. Prime Minister.
I certainly do, Mr. Speaker, and I think that fraud is corrosive of public trust and wasteful of public money, and it is absolutely vital that all councillors learn the lessons of that report, and I thank him for drawing it to the attention of the House.
So the temptation is, to award certain contracts to certain people without going through the proper process, in certainly no public process, which is what happened down at Temple Island. It's also happened at Cannon's Marsh with this, apparently, according to George there, and our little exclusive. But also, Martin, we've got another problem, haven't we? And that is that this company Into has gone bust that runs these big shopping centres like Cribbs Causeway. So is it just a question of them changing hands and we won't notice any difference? Or does it matter if a big chain like this goes bust?
Well, there's two separate strands there. Of course, what's going to happen is there's going to be massive economic restructuring, and that's putting it mildly. I mean, we're basically heading into a property crash and mass unemployment. And, of course, that's going to basically unbalance the books of local authorities. It may well be that all these schemes for development, like the massive tower that's being built next to Castle Park, it may well be that the line of credit for that will run out before it's even built. That's how serious the situation is. And, we're going to be in crisis management mode from here on in.
What about something like Hinkley? You know, that's even bigger, isn't it? A massive project, yep, which is half built now.
Yeah, but of course, what you've got, because that's basically central government driven, you may find that, when Boris Johnson was talking about build the other day, he means things like HS2 and that. Now, of course, I would argue that they are white elephants and never going to make any money, which is another reason why it may not happen.
Well, so,
we may find a situation where we're not actually doing anything very much because the money's simply not there because there's been a...
Well, not according to Boris, and that speech you were mentioning this week, it was, I suppose, a sort of we're coming out of lockdown speech, really, and saying that not only are we doing that, but we're also planning, and this is the amazing thing, to do something like the New Deal of FDR. Now, is he just exaggerating there? Is there any possibility? Because this is the sort of thing you've been talking about doing for years, Martin. Finally, we need FDR back again.
Well, what he's doing is he's grabbing the name of FDR off the shelf. But of course, the amount of money that FDR spent was absolutely enormously more than he's talking about. The other thing that FDR did, he set up the Pecora Commission, which basically sent loads of bankers to prison and all sorts of stuff like that. They encouraged trade unions to form in industries where they weren't, where they're being repressed. There was a wave of strikes which were backed by the government.
And there was an attempted an attempted coup against him too, wasn't there?
There was an attempted coup against him by Prescott Bush and others. Boris Johnson is basically, he's a lightweight, frankly, and he's gesturing in the direction of something.
But anyway, let's have a think. Let's listen now to what he had to say earlier this week.
This moment also gives us a much greater chance to be radical and to do things differently, to build back better and to build back bolder. And so we will be doubling down on our strategy. We will double down on leveling up, if you can make sense of that. And when I say level up, I don't mean attacking our great companies, or I don't mean impeding the success of London, far from it, or launching some punitive raid on the wealth creators. I don't believe in tearing people down any more than I believe in tearing down statues that are part of our heritage, let alone a statue of our greatest wartime leader. I believe in building people up, giving everyone growing up in this country the opportunity they need. Whoever you are, whatever your ethnicity, whatever your background, and there are certain things that are indispensable for that opportunity. Hospital you're born in, schools you go to, the safety of the streets where you grow up. And this government has not forgotten that we were elected to build 40 new hospitals. And we will. Matt Hancock is setting out the list in the next few days, and that is just the beginning. We will continue and step up the biggest ever program of funding the NHS. And we won't wait to fix the problems of social care that every government has flunked for the last 30 years. We will end the injustice that some people have to sell their homes to finance the cost of their care while others don't. And we're finalising our plans, and we will build a cross-party consensus. We want to look after those who have looked after us. And at the same time, we will build the foundations now for future prosperity to make this country a Britain that is fully independent and self-governing for the first time in 45 years, the most attractive place to live, to invest, to set up a company, with the most motivated and highly skilled workforce. And so we're investing massively now in education, with over £14 billion for primary and secondary education between now and 2023. And today, with a new 10-year school building programme, beginning now with £1 billion for the first 50 schools, and a vast £1.5 billion programme for refurbishing our dilapidated FE sector. Dilapidated in many places, not here, of course. Because it's time. It's time that the system recognised that talent and genius are expressed as much by hand and by eye as they are by a spreadsheet or an essay. So when I say unite and level up, when I say build up people and build up talent, I want to end the current injustice. That means a pupil from a London state school is now 50% more likely to go to a top university than a pupil from the West Midlands. And that is not only unjust, it is such a waste of human talent. We will unleash the potential of the entire country. And that means basic things, cracking down again on the crime that blights too many of our streets and too many lives. And we'll get on with our plan to recruit 20,000 more police officers. We've already found 3,000, already recruited 3,000. And I thank the police again for everything they're doing and have done in this crisis. And we will back our police all the way and give our justice system the powers we need to end the lunacy that stops us, for instance, deporting some violent offenders, just as we've already stopped the automatic early release of terrorists. We'll make this country safer. We will build the hospitals, build the schools, the colleges, but we will also build back greener. and build a more beautiful Britain. We will protect our landscape with flood defences and plant 30,000 hectares of trees every year, creating a new patchwork of woodlands to enchant and re-energise the soul. And in those towns that feel left behind, we have plans to invest in their centres, new academy schools, new green buses, new broadband, and we want to make them places where people have the confidence to stay, to raise their families, to start businesses, and not to feel that all the action is in the cities or in the metropolis.
So that's Prime Minister, Tory Prime Minister Boris Johnson speaking earlier this week in Dudley, Martin. Just in a nutshell, you think it's all just hot air?
Largely. And of course, the real problem is we've had 10 years. You mentioned police officers there. They sacked 20,000 police officers. And now
this is a new government, though, isn't it?
Well, it is, but it's the same party in power. And the austerity of the last, I mean, why has the NHS not been prepared for this pandemic? Because it's been starved of money because we bailed the banks out. And of course, the underlying
all of this. Gordon Brown did.
Well, Gordon Brown, not George Brown. George Brown's from the 1960s.
Gordon Brown did that, yeah.
Gordon Brown did that. And of course, we did that. When you bailed the banks out, we should have taken control at that point and put in place a new deal.
Well, we didn't take control. We just didn't use it, did we?
Well, we haven't used it. And of course, what's happened is that the banks have collapsed again and been bailed out again. And of course, what he's talking about there is he's going to fund all of this by borrowing. Now, that's all very well when interest rates are at zero, which is what they are at the moment. Although, of course, you could always have borrowed during the last 10 years. There was no reason for austerity in the last 10 years. But what may happen now with a no deal Brexit is there'll be a run on the pound, and then they'll have to raise interest rates in order to protect the currency. And we'll just fall down into a massive crash, which will only be dealt with by massive investment, which will involve raising taxes on the wealthy. And they've got to face this up. The wealthy are made out like bandits in this coronavirus crisis in Britain and elsewhere.
I mean, you've been saying over the years.
It's only become because the state has stepped in to back up.
Martin, you've been saying over the years.
That money is our money and we want it back.
What you've been saying over the years is that they shouldn't be trying to balance the books. They should be spending and borrowing, and that's what he's doing.
Yes, but you spend and borrow, but you can only do that to a certain extent. And the reason you won't, it's not enough. You've also got to actually rebalance the tax system. So in the 1950s, when we fought the Battle of the Imjin River in North Korea, when we were invading North Korea, and we also built up the health service, the top rate of tax in this country was 95%. And everybody thinks, well, that's ridiculous. You can't have a 95% tax rate. You can. We did.
Yep.
We did.
And maybe, who knows, maybe at some point we will. Anyway, thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers there. Just join us in a minute as we take our weekly look around the world. First, some music.